infected!
Infected! Infected with what?
In the blood.
We have to leave now. More infected will be coming. They always do.
Hey, hear them.
I can see them, they're coming!
Hannah, I love you very much. Keep away from me.
Keep away from me!
Dad?
Keep away from me!
Jimmy's infected! Jim, kill it!
I don't think they are coming back. I think they've been killed. They're dead. And you're gonna be next.
No!
It's just you and me now, darling. But don't worry. I'm gonna get you out of here. Then we're gonna find a nice little fucking place somewhere. Ah!
Ah! Ah! Ah! 28 Days Later is, I think, one of the best British horror films. Probably ever. And definitely of this century. And to me, it just completely reinvented the so-called zombie horror film, and was shot for hardly any money compared to some of the other big-budget horror films that are coming out today. And the performances in particular for me in this film are absolutely fantastic and really give the heart to the film. So definitely a film, if you haven't seen, to go and watch. And if you have seen it, to do what I just did recently, was revisit it and realize, you know, it still holds up today, and it's, what, 14 years later since it was released. It's a great film.
That was Richard Brake talking about Danny Boyle's horror thriller 28 Days Later. Mr. Brake is an actor known for his work in such films as Stephen Norrington's Death Machine, Cold Mountain, Batman Begins, Doom, Hannibal Rising, and 2009's Halloween 2. He was also recently seen scaring the living hell out of audiences in Rob Zombie's 31 as that film's iconic villain, Doomhead. Mr. Brake, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I got to ask, given the opportunity to choose any horror movie for discussion, any at all to talk about at length, what made you land on 28 Days Later?
You know, and it's funny, you sent me that, you know, we talked and you said, pick a film. And I was like, oh. And it came almost immediately to me, 28 Days Later. I mean, I went back. I love some of the old 70s films, you know, Texas Chainsaw, all those, I Spit on Your Grave. I love those films. But to me, 28 Days Later, it rejuvenated me into horror films. I mean, I have to say that I was, I was a teenager in the 80s, and I'm not a big fan of those sort of sleek 80s horror films that came out. I watched all of them, but by the 90s, I was not even, I don't think I'd watched a horror film in so long. And then, which I'll get to later for personal reasons, I went to see 28 Days Later on my own one cold November day in London in 2002 when it came out. And, you know, theater wasn't very busy, and just sat there with afternoon screening, and it just blew me away. I realized what you could do with a horror film beyond just scaring people, and not to mention it's scary as hell. So, it was right away. It was first choice when you asked me.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, too. I mean, at that point when the movie came out, I felt like I'd sort of given up on horror. You know, a bit anyway. I mean, I still loved horror movies, and I still collected, you know, Fangoria magazine every month. But, you know, it felt like the genre had sort of died out somewhat in the 90s and then was kind of revitalized with Scream in 96. But then we were kind of inundated with new slick, self-aware slashers until the early aughts. But yet we had that sort of J-horror trend that kind of started to seep in with Ringu and its American remake, which was great. But I mean, it felt like it was around 2002, 2003 that you could really start to feel a bit of a resurgence in the genre. You know, there was that Texas Chainsaw remake and then Freddy versus Jason, which was fun. And then we had Wrong Turn and, you know, like Willard and Cabin Fever and High Tension being released in France. But, you know, when we got 28 Days Later, it felt like it was the one that sort of really kick-started the wave for sort of serious and, you know, brutal horror films, you know, along with, you know, Rob Zombie's House of 1,000 Corpses. And, you know, it wasn't long after that that the so-called torture porn run began, with films like Saw and Hostel being, you know, sort of becoming super popular in multiplexes. But Can I ask, like, out of all the horror flicks, you know, all the various types and subgenres that I just mentioned, do you lean as a fan toward any specific type or subgenre?
I have to admit, I love zombie / infected films. So, I mean, I've always, I auditioned really early for, like, way before it was released, The Walking Dead, that series. And I remember thinking, geez, and I knew Frank Darabont from before, and I was like, what a genius move. Because, you know, the way that, for me, that genre can talk about so much more than just horror. I think I think it's true of all horror films, but in particular, I find that genre can be very reflective of society and the problems that we have today. And I knew in that series there was opportunities for that. And I think that Danny Boyle does it with 28 Days Later and Georgia Romero. If I had to pick one, I think that's it. But I don't really lean towards torture porn as much. I've seen a few. It doesn't really excite me that much. And weirdly, like, horror comedy is something I never really liked, except I guess some people would call Scream that. I thought Scream, you mentioned that earlier, and I was like, yeah, I forgot how brilliant that was when I saw that. When it came out in 96? I thought it was just genius, absolute genius, that film. And if I had to pick a second one, I'd probably pick that, but I have a feeling you must have had a few people already choose that one. But those are my, that's what, sort of what I lean towards. If I had to pick anything, but I love, you know, I love, anything that's a good film, you know, any horror film that's really, you know, it's just, is a good film that goes beyond just trying to freak me out, or, you know, that's got something going for it that's a little bit more. I love that. It makes me think. I love a horror film that makes me think a bit.
Oh, same here. And the zombie subgenre definitely can have that, you know, in spades, I think, you know, depending on the filmmaker who's sort of telling that story. Definitely Romero, and definitely Danny Boyle with 28 Days.
Yeah, Romero, when he did, you know, that the second one that's in the shopping mall, that's Day of the Dead, right?
I mean, Dawn. I think it's Night, Dawn, and Day.
And it was the late 70s, that one came out, right? That's just genius to me. The whole idea of consumerism and the way he approaches that. I mean, I love that. I love that film. I think it was just brilliant. And then Danny Boyle again in 28 Days Later.
You know, I was just going to mention, like, you know, we're talking zombie movies, and I think 28 Days Later is the movie that's sort of acknowledged as being the one that started up the fast zombies trend in movies. I don't think it's the first film with fast zombies, but it certainly sort of popularized that approach.
Because that was when I remember coming out of it, of seeing the film that cold, rainy November day, and clearly thinking, fast zombies, what a genius move. And do you know what film might have been before that that did it then? Because I've always tried to work out if there was anyone that came up with the fast zombies before.
I don't know that there were any sort of like, well, maybe, I mean,
we'll have to Google.
To an extent, Return of the Living Dead, maybe. Even though, I mean, it's more of a send-up, I think, for the most part, of zombie films than a straightforward one. But
yeah. So, because that's what I think, you know, I mean, I've seen people sit and debate for hours the fast zombie versus, well, you know, for hours, but the fast zombie versus the slow zombie debate. And, I mean, I love both. I think there's advantages to both. But I definitely think Danny Boyle in 28 Days Later, by making those cuts, I mean, not just fast, I mean, like, super quick, the way he shot it, and also incredibly strong. Like, I could, you know, knock through doors and get through, you know, car windows. So they were, I mean, just, it was terrifying. I mean, really terrifying.
Yeah, out of all the ones that followed in its wake, I mean, you know, we had the Dawn of the Dead remake, which came out about a year later, which I really like. I don't think it has any sort of, like, subtext going on like the Romero movie. But, you know, we had that. We had Zombieland. We had World War Z and the Crazies remake. But I think 28 Days Later is the one that did it best so far.
Yeah. I think it's partly the way he shot it, too. If you know, because I, you know, he shot it with, you know, most of that is shot on digital video, which at the time, you probably know all this, but at the time was incredibly, I mean, I don't think I'd ever shot a real movie on digital video at that point. I mean, and only real movies were shot on film. Nobody used video. And in that film, Danny Boyle uses primarily video cameras. And of course, video wasn't even as developed as it is today. And now today, you never shoot on film hardly ever anymore. And I think partly the way he was shooting that with the kind of camera he was using, and the when he would slow it down or speed it up or whatever, created this kind of jagged thing. That if you watch the way the infected move when they're attacking, it created this kind of unusual sort of stuttering sort of movement that makes them even more terrifying, I think. Yeah. And again, that I think a result really primarily of shooting with this kind of, at the time, new format that the proper directors, and I'm holding on my finger saying this, you know, in quotation marks, but didn't use, you know, video cameras. And Danny Boyle, because of his budget and because of the time they had to shoot this, shot this on video. And I think that to me really is a big plus of that film, is the fact that it looks so lo-fi at times because of the kind of equipment. And they were using video cameras. In some of the scenes, you could buy them, you know, on the street for, you know, $2,000. You know, Canon XL1s, I think they were shooting some of it with, which at the time was the best kind of camera you could buy if you just went down to the, you know, kind of video store. But that's, you know, I think that actually, to me, benefits the whole film. It gives it a real feeling that you're almost watching this kind of grimy, you know, broken down look that camera gave the whole film. I think really, really, really works, as opposed to a sleek sheen look you get sometimes on film.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it is crazy. I mean, you're right. It has that lo-fi look and it has kind of a ragged look too. But, and yet, you know, with Boyle's eye, it's still sort of kind of, it's beautifully shot, yeah. You know, even though he is shooting mini DV. And I think it perfectly illustrates how little the medium or the resolution on display, you know, matters when it comes to the talent of the filmmaker and the, you know, the strength of the story that's being told. I mean, it's a beautifully composed movie, regardless of the very video look that it has at times.
Yeah, it really is. When I was watching it again, I realized, you know, because if you think there's very few, ultimately, there's not that many locations. I mean, I almost could count them all. I was trying to. And there's hardly, a lot of it's interior or smaller areas, you know, shooting outside, but in really contained area. And yet, and even though it's got this kind of, it's low budget or the rest of it, there's a sort of epic feel to it. You really get the sense that this has happened, which I think is incredibly difficult to achieve. And almost sort of take it for granted that he's done this. But because I've seen people shoot sort of low budget films, you know, that don't get released. And I've watched, you know, friends try and shoot a film and give it a sense of being an epic sort of feel to it. And they can't really do it. And yet somehow on a fairly low budget using, not the highest grade equipment, but through his eye, like you say, I think through the production design as well, which is so good. And the performances, there's a real feeling that of a kind of bigness to it, like an epicness. Like you get a real sense that, you know, this has happened. This whole kind of infected thing. You get a real sense of it being much bigger than it is when you think about the reality of how little they had to shoot with. They still achieved it. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, I mean the whole sequence with him walking through London, and it's just, you know, he's alone. It's terrifying, but it does feel epic at times. It does feel big. You know, you feel like the world has been hollowed out. It's the perfect sort of note, I think, to set that story out on. It's so creepy. But I would love to know how he managed to do that. I think I'd heard on like one of the commentaries
I know how he does that, because, you know, here's a little inside thing. I was doing prior to, like, in 14 years ago, almost to the day, I was in October. I was shooting Cold Mountain. I went to do, you know, there's an Antonin Minghella film, Cold Mountain, with Jude Law. And I went to Romania for a week to shoot this film. And in this, I'm in a scene with Natalie Portman, where we attack Natalie Portman's house and her baby and all this stuff. And there was me and two other guys. And one of those other actors was a guy by the name of Killian Murphy. And Killian and I hung out. We were in the middle of Romania, like literally in the middle of nowhere, in this ski resort off season, staying in the ski. And we just became really great friends on this time. We just had a lot of time together. We both had a lot of things in common, both like novelists and certain kind of films. And we just really, really hit it off. And at the time, he was kind of, you know, both of us have pretty small parts in this film. And he wasn't the man we know, not Killian Murphy, the megastar he is. You know, he was fairly unknown British actor. But he was telling me about this film he'd done with Danny Boyle that was coming out about 2 weeks, a zombie movie. And I thought, yeah, right, we'll see about this. Not really too impressed by it. And, of course, that was the reason I went 2 weeks later to see it. Because as I said, I hadn't really been a big horror fan for about 10, 15 years. Liked Scream, but that was it. But because my mate was in it, I thought I should go and have a look. And he was telling me that those scenes that they shot, they had to do very, very early in the morning. Literally, they had to be there before sun came up so they could be all prepped up. But again, because they were using these, and he told me they were shooting it on video cameras. And I was like, video cameras? You shot this video cameras? And you expect it to do well? So anyway, they got there. They had to get there before sun came up, put makeup on and all that stuff. And then and they would block the streets off, but for short periods of time because, you know, they didn't have the kind of budget where they get the whole Metropolitan Police in to block it off for a morning. So because it was Sunday morning, they would shoot, I think, Sunday mornings in particular. It was quiet. Britain tends to not wake up until about noon on Sunday. So they would quickly block off little blocks of street and just shoot very quickly. But because the cameras were so quick to set up, they could shoot six cameras fast, boom, and then just be out of there. So that was pretty much how it was done. Very quick, very fast, and very early in the morning on a Sunday.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of that sequence, too. I mean, the way the movie opens, you know, not just with him walking around London, but the idea that he has sort of kind of been born into the post-infected world by virtue of the fact that he was in a coma and he wakes up in a hospital. You know, it reminded me that, you know, at the time when the movie came out, I was a huge Romero fan. I mean, I still am. But, you know, I always kept an eye out for sort of zombie-related tales of any sort, you know. And even though there weren't many at the time, it's hard to imagine there was a time when zombies weren't popular. But, you know, at around the time that we got 28 Days Later, there was also The Walking Dead. And I think there was a super popular zombie novel at the time called The Rising as well. And you know, both of them, all of them actually, opened in roughly the same way, with the protagonist awakening in a hospital, having been in a coma as the world sort of sank into the zombie apocalypse. And it's a fascinating way, I think, to introduce a character into that world. And it's kind of crazy to think that three different properties essentially did the same thing and all, you know, apparently independent of one another. So, but yeah, and then, you know, only a handful of years later, we got The Walking Dead on television, which kind of did the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the graphic novels were probably almost identical time as 28 Days Later, right? I would think that's probably really similar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Time.
Yeah. And it's such a great way to introduce this to.
Oh, it's brilliant, isn't it? And he gets, you know, and again, you know, you get a real sense right away of what's going on when he wakes up, you know, and then you have him stark naked and you see him. And I love the little details that the film has, because if you look, you know, the side of his head is shaved, the side of Killian Murphy's head has been shaved, so he's obviously had some kind of operation on his brain. And you know, there's no mention of it, you just can see, like, oh, okay, he must have had a brain injury. You know, as walking through the streets of London, I could see the shaved head, and it grown just the amount you could tell that, you know, someone had been operated on, say, a month earlier. You know, I love, like, there's just lots of little details like that that I think really stand out for me in the film, which make it that even that more special.
You're right. He even has that tiny little scar, I think, on his head that he sort of sports throughout. And yeah, you're right. We never get any long-winded exposition explaining what the deal with it is.
No, you just know he's a bike courier and he's, you know, got knocked over somewhere. But yeah, no, I love that.
You know, at times the movie, you know, we've mentioned Romero a couple of times. The movie itself feels, you know, Fast Zombies aside, it feels like a big homage to Romero at times. You know, the movie starts with, you know, the protagonist sort of coming to grips with what's going on, and he holes up in a house with other survivors until they're attacked, and then he finds himself in the company of others, and he eventually goes on a fun shopping spree in a market, and then he runs afoul of dodgy military types who have their own, you know, zombie pet, you know, a fellow soldier who's now undead. You know, right there, that's Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead, right there, covered in, you know, one fell swoop.
Yeah, I don't think that was probably a coincidence at all. I think that because Alex Garland wrote it, right? He was he wrote 20 Days Later. He was a novelist as well, and I think that if I can remember from things I'd read, or that he was definitely a Romero fan, and I think that without a doubt it was intentional that you have really all three movies in one. You got the house, you got the shopping mall, and then you've got the military, which again is brilliant. You know, kind of. And I guess there's also reference that I was reading to Alex Garland saying that there was a film or a novel that's really famous in Britain, especially when I was a young kid growing up there, called Day of the Triffids.
Oh, yeah.
Which was made into a film that was also kind of a British horror film in the 60s, I think, which again starts with somebody waking up from accident or coma, and then the world's gone crazy. And I think that was a big influence in his work as well on this. There might be military in that one as well. But going back sort of to British horror films of the 60s, which I used to watch a lot of too growing up.
I adore that period. I'm a huge Hammer fan. Yeah. So.
Every morning, every Saturday morning, there'd be a Hammer horror film on.
That's so great.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Alex Garland's too. He, you mentioned he was a novelist. He wrote the source material for, he wrote the book, The Beach, which became, the Danny Boyle movie, and it seemed like they started working together after that. And I got to ask, have you seen their follow-up to 28 Days Later, the big sci-fi film Sunshine?
I have. Again, the Cillian Murphy in that as well. I really liked it. A lot of people didn't as much, but
I loved it.
Yeah, I really liked it. I have to go watch that one again. I saw it when it came out, which is what, 2007 or something like that.
Yeah, I believe so.
I thought it was brilliant. Again, just had so much in it to think about, as well as being just entertaining. On one level, I just felt that there was. I remember coming away, sort of with my head spinning around, thinking about some of the ideas that it was addressing. But yeah, I really liked that film a lot. It's got a again, another great cast. I mean, Danny Boyle always to me, a lot of what makes 28 Days Later so fantastic is the performances. I always say I'm biased, a good friend of Killian's, but I really think, watching what he does is for so little, he's such an understated kind of actor, but you get a real sense of what he's going through. And also he does that great thing, which I think is really hard to do for lead actors, and that's to let us experience it through him, what's going on, not to overact. Tendency for actors is to overact, and he really doesn't do that. So we get a real, I think, emotional connection to him, and then to Naomi Harris, who plays, I forget her name, Serena or...
Selena.
Selena. And, I think that, it's our attachment to those two guys, to those two characters, and also to Frank, Brendan Gleeson, who's brilliant in it, absolutely brilliant in it. And so, he's hardly in it really. He's in, that little middle section, the taxi driver guy. And, he's just, and his daughter and their relationship. I mean, you really get attached to these people in such a short time. Not a lot of dialogue, not a lot of backstory, we got very little, and yet we have a kind of real, emotional attachment to them, which I think says a lot about the performances of those four actors in the film. And I think that's something that sometimes, horror can be so, there's so many other things in it. You have running zombies, you have, military, you have shoot-ups, you got gore, you've got this, that you kind of can sometimes forget, or some people can forget how important it is to have good actors and how good acting can really elevate a film, especially a genre film, where there's so much other stuff that takes our attention that we sometimes don't notice what a simple good performance does to actually make the film so good. And I think 28 Days Later is a really good example of that. Even Christopher Eccleston plays the major. You know, I think that's one of the best things he does. You know, he's just kind of, you could see his conflictedness between wanting to basically give his men the women, but also, you know, this bit of him that, yeah, I think he's not just this evil, bad guy. I think, and again, there's very, he doesn't have a lot of dialogue. There's not a lot of, you can just see things going on. I mean, I think some of those performances in particular really hold up, have a lot to do with why that's such a good film. And I think that's not always noticed.
I agree. It is an excellent cast. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned Eccleston. You're right. He really manages to humanize, you know, Major West. You know, he's obviously a bastard and he's doing terrible things. But in a way, you always kind of, without agreeing with it, without letting him off the hook, you always kind of understand why he's doing it. You always get the sense that he feels what he's doing is best for his men. You know, he's doing the best that he can with the circumstances he's given, which makes him in a way even more of a scarier villain in a sense, in that way, because he believes he's right.
Yeah. I mean, it really is really chilling in it. And I love, there's a moment that where one of his guy at the end, when he comes in and like all his men have been wiped out, there's one that's sort of dying. I think the one that Jim stabs, and you know, he just holds his hand. And yeah, it's a really, really simple moment where Danny Boyle just keeps the camera on him while he's holding his hand while this guy dies. You know, it's little tiny things like that that I think really make, this is one of the reasons why this film is so fantastic. I mean, it's almost like there's, I was thinking about it, it's kind of note perfect parts. I mean, there's a few things that don't quite work for me, especially in the military bit at the end. Some of the performances are a little over the top, a little general with some of the soldiers, and I would think if Danny Boyle had a little more time, he might have toned some of their performances, because I thought some of that doesn't work as like talking note perfect, but some of it's just like that moment where he's holding his hand. And I thought of another moment that I think is amazing in the film, is when Brendan Gleeson, Frank the taxi driver, gets the infected, dropped the blood in his eye, and there's that moment where he just turns, you know, he's just argued with his kid, with everybody, and he turns and apologizes to his daughter. He knows he only has 15 seconds, so he turns, apologizes to his daughter for getting angry, tells her how much he loves her, and then he's like, stay away, and you know, they have to kill him. And it's, you know, 50, but it's so powerful, that just, and it's just so well done. You know, in some films, there would have been this long, over the top music playing, really loud, you know, sad music, and oh, poor Frank's going and stuff. But it just, it's right. To me, it's note perfect. It's really moving, really sad. You know, I have, anyone has children knows that, you know, it's just incredibly sad. But it's 15 seconds, you know, or a couple of lines, and it's just delivered. It's perfect to me. That moments like that really make this such a great film.
I agree. And the fact that, you know, Boyle doesn't underline it, you're right, he doesn't bring in the music and he doesn't do all of the tricks one would expect, it makes it even more tragic as a result, when it's kind of viewed, not dispassionately, but he sort of steps away and just lets the actors do their work. And I think that might actually be my favorite moment in the film.
Yeah, I can see why. I mean, it really is. It's just brilliant.
But you are right, too, talking about the military. I mean, it does feel like, I wonder how much of it is performance, and I wonder how much of the, and I, you know, I hate to knock the movie. I love the writing. I love the movie. But, you know, when you mention the military, it does feel like even the writing kind of paints the soldiers as a little cartoony in a way. You know, I mean, you have all those soldiers led by, you know, Eccleston's West, and they're all bastards. And then, you know, you, except for Mailer, the zombie, you know, and you have the one poor bastard who's dissented, and he's killed in the same execution party that's meant to be, you know, Jim's end as well later on. But, you know, I wonder if those two characters, you know, do you think the writer felt as though he needed one or two? I mean, if we want to count the zombie as being a redeemable character, but do you think he felt he needed one or two redeemable soldiers in order to sort of really lay into the military, you know, with the portrayal of those other characters?
In terms of the sergeant being redeemable, or the
oh, even I mean, even the guy who, you know, is sort of executed, he's the one guy who's saying that West is insane and the whole thing is terrible. You know, we, as long as we have one guy who's saying that this is bad, you know, as long as we have one guy in the military who can represent, you know, the sort of the good in the military, I guess, then it almost feels like that Garland used that for leverage to be able to paint the rest of the soldiers in sort of a almost like a cartoonishly evil way.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that, you know, I mean, to me, that is the sort of weakest part of the film. I think that in a weird way, that that's the sergeant, the one who's the redeemable character who gets killed. And I think to me, he's almost to me, he's most realistic in a weird way. I think the problem really lies in that this is me being a little bit tough, but there's like four or five young actors playing the army guys, and the dialogue's not Garland's best at that point. And there's a lot of, I'm gonna fuck you, I'm gonna make you squirt, baby, and all this kind of stuff. And I think these young actors, having been a young, you know, one time I was a young actor, and you know, there's a tendency to really want to show how great you are and go in there. And I think the performances are just, very, like you said, really cartoony, and not helped by fairly cartoony dialogue parts there. But again, that dialogue, when I was thinking about it, could have been underplayed, could have been done differently. I think they just get, I don't believe they're soldiers almost at that point. I think the four or five performances in there kind of throw it off a bit for me, but I love the film so much, and I'm following Jim at this point, and you you're coming to the end of it, and that, you know, I can sort of let that go. But if this is being really tough on the film, you know, really looking at the detail, I do think that those four or five performances the actors were having a little too much fun playing the baddies in that bit. And I don't think that was necessary. The situation is bad enough. You know, you've got infected coming in any second. You've got two women that you're about to rape, one who's 14. You don't need to play it as psycho baddies either. You know, army men out to get a shag. I mean, it's scary enough. They just want to have a shag. I mean, they haven't for God knows how long. So I think that would have been if it had been a bit more real, a little more in that period, I would have been a little happier with the film. I think it loses reality a bit there.
I agree. Although, just play devil's advocate for just a second. I agree with you, but it is funny that, you know, when West dies, you do feel a little bit bad. Like he's a bad man, but you kind of understand where he was coming from. And so even when he dies, even for all the horrible stuff that he's done, there is a sense of it being a little melancholy, you know, but with the other military men, because they are so cartoonishly evil at times there, but you know, I wonder if it would have felt as satisfying if they hadn't been so, you know, cartoonishly evil, you know, watching all of them sort of get taken out by Jim and Mailer at that point in the movie.
No, I think you're probably right. I mean, that is a good point, because you do enjoy watching Jim come back and sort of do his Bruce Willis thing, which you get if you nitpick. I mean, he was a bicycle courier, and then he takes out six military men. But it's great to watch. I love that. But yeah,
it is crazy that he, you know, Jim doesn't really have much of an arc in the film. You know, he goes, you pointed out, he starts from being a fairly, maybe this is a bit too harsh, but he goes from being kind of a weak character in the beginning to a warrior by the end, you know, to protect his new family. And I wonder if that's maybe only because he's kind of terrified of being alone. You know, we see how being the lone man in a full city terrifies him at the very beginning, as it would anybody. But, you know, he also has that nightmare when he wakes up and everyone's left him, you know, his new family. And yet at the end, I believe he genuinely wants to save Selena and Hannah because he's a good man and doesn't want any harm to befall them. But I wonder if part of what fuels him and allows him to be a sort of a warrior at the end is the fact that he's just so very scared of being alone again.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also think that that's a real big theme to one of to this film. And I think to a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff that I've read or watched, because I tend to like post-apocalyptic. I think it's great opportunities for us to show humanity. And I think one of the big things in this film is, for Jim, is the realization that, as I think he says, or Selena says, that, you know, there's more to it than just surviving. And I think it's the connection that he feels to both Selena and to Hannah, that he develops through the film, that makes him realize there's more than just being alive. So just surviving, just going off and surviving, whether it be, you know, on his own, isn't satisfactory enough. That the connection with human beings, the connection of two people, the need for us to be connected, whether it be love or just, you know, whatever, a connection with another human being, is essential. And that's, you know, that's the reason to stay alive. And I think he realizes that, and that's kind of what sends it back. I think to me that's really a big part of the film, is that, you know, we need each other. You know, we need to feel connected to other human beings. We need to feel that, to feel alive. Otherwise, just being alive, there's no point. You know, just being alive, what's the point of it? It's a connection with others that's important. So for me, that's really what sends Jim back again. And that, you know, that's obviously not being alone, but I think it really is being connected to Selena and Hannah.
I agree. And it's definitely, you know, Selena sort of shares in that, I think, too. You know, she, when we meet her, she's obviously somebody who's had a very hard time of things, and she sort of closed herself off to everyone. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, Jim may be the film's lead, but it's really Selena who has the sort of major arc in the film. You know, when we meet her, she goes from someone who can kill in an instant to protect herself, you know, somebody who wants no attachments, to being somebody who becomes protective of others. And, you know, she can't bring herself to kill Jim when she believes he might be infected, because she cares about him too much. And, you know, I think in a way it makes it an oddly romantic film at times.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I think, again, like we were saying earlier, it's so understated. You know, there's no big, oh, they've fallen in love, and, you know, music rising. And it's just you see them slowly connect. And obviously, there's this, you know, slight romance starting to develop. They have that big kiss, you know, when he's all bloody at the end. But it's all done incredibly subtly, in a way that just understated, which is what I love about the film. You really feel the connection growing between the two of them throughout, but done, you know, without any big scenes or big dialogue or big rising music or whatever. It's just gentle and subtle, no perfect. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, even that early moment when you know, they're all camping out. Well, it's the day before or whatever. And she just gives him like a quick peck on the cheek, you know, and yeah. Then there's that weird, awkward moment between them where, you know, I mean, up until that point, I think Jim has been borderline terrified of her. Yeah. And then there's that oddly sweet moment. It's just, yeah, it's, I love the movie for moments like that. I mean, it's a horror film. It's a zombie film. It's intent. You know, I think in addition to making you think, I mean, you know, its primary intent, I think, is to scare and to frighten. And yet, when I think back to all my favorite moments in the movie, it's the moments between the characters. It's those tiny little interactions that humanize them and make us, you know, fear for them all the more when things do get crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really what makes the film stand out. I mean, you know, without those, it'd still be a really scary film, and it'd be great. The fact that he's introduced or reintroduced or galvanated the fast zombie and all of these things would, you know, still make it highly entertaining. But I think what makes me immediately think of it as the film to choose for us to chat about is those little moments that, you know, I didn't even remember when you asked me which film, because I hadn't seen it for 12, 14 years. But, you know, when I rewatched it, I was like, oh, that's why this film stays in my memory so much. Because it's got it transcends just being entertaining and terrifying, with just tiny little moments like that.
Yeah, I agree. And plus bolstered, too, by an amazing musical score. I mean,
yeah.
You're right. They never bring in, like, big music. There are never big moments. And yet the score is kind of perfect. It perfectly sets the mood for that world and, you know, to ratchet up the tension at times. And yet it it never overpowers the movie, even when the music gets really big. You know, there's that great track, I think it's called In the House of Heartbeat, that plays during the climax when, you know, Jim and Mailer are sort of attacking the mansion and all of West's men. And, you know, it's just an incredible piece of music. I think it's been used to death in various trailers since. But, yeah, just incredible, incredible music throughout.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, I noticed that. It's not a surprise for a Danny Boyle film. But it's because he always puts pretty good music in his films.
Yeah. And, can I ask, are you a Danny Boyle fan?
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of hard not to be, but I mean.
Exactly. What I love about Danny Boyle is the way he, you know, doesn't stick with one thing. I mean, you never know what he's going to do next. Everything he really jumps around from lots of different ideas and films. Like, you know, when Killian said that he's doing a zombie film directed by Danny Boyle, I was like, the Danny Boyle? Danny Boyle with Trainspotting? Like, yeah. Like, wow. I love his work, you know. And then wasn't shortly after this he did Slumdog Millionaire, which is, you know, completely different.
Yeah, it's amazing, like, how he doesn't seem to be linked solely to one genre. He can jump about and do completely different things, and yet he seems like a master at all of them. You know, even like his first movie, you know, Shallow Grave, you know, that's this tense little thriller, and you see that and you're like, oh, this is a guy who's clearly going to have a career that could mirror Hitchcock, you know. But then he does Trainspotting, and then from that he does A Life Less Ordinary, which is a movie that I think it's an underloved gem. I think it's a really cool movie. But then, you know, The Beach, and then he does 28 Days Later, and then Sunshine, a big sci-fi movie, and then you're right, Slumdog Millionaire, and 127 Hours. It's just, and then Steve Jobs, you know, just a year or two ago. So his filmography is kind of incredible.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's more like he's fascinated by, you know, just filmmaking, finding different projects of work that he wants to do, and does them, and there's no connection between them. I mean, you could be impossible to really connect all those films, other than I think he's really good at putting a level of humanity in everything he does. I haven't seen Steven Jobs, but you know, all those films you just mentioned, you know, whether they be Shallow Grave or whatever, he's got a good heart. I mean, I've not actually worked with him, but I've had many friends who have, and they all speak incredibly highly of him. As a person as well as a director. It's just, you know, it's got a big heart, I think.
Yeah, so definitely. That does seem to be the one thing that links all of his work together. You're right. I mean, certainly not like thematically or genre-wise, but you're right. I mean, it is the humanity I think he brings to his characters.
Yeah.
And it'll be very curious to see him do Trainspotting 2. I think that'll be the first time in his career he's done a sequel directly, so I'm curious to see what it's like. Him going back to one of his, you know, already established worlds.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Speaking of sequels, though, I mean, he elected to only produce 28 Weeks Later, the follow-up to 28 Days, and another filmmaker took the reins on that. Can I ask, have you seen the sequel, and what did you think of it?
No, haven't. I was trying to remember. I thought maybe I had watched it, like, one night on, you know, DVD or something with one of my kids. I was trying. If I watched it, I have no memory of it. I mean, that's, and I hate to say that, but I don't think I did. Partly, I didn't want to watch it for a long time because I kind of felt that he wasn't directing it, and I even though I know he's producing, but in the film world, that can mean a lot of things. But sometimes it's just me putting their name to it, you know, just because, you know, and I wasn't sure how involved he might have been. And I kind of felt the first one stood so well on its own. I didn't want to ruin that by watching it. I'll have to go back because, I mean, I've had other people, I've heard friends tell me that they really liked it and really enjoyed it. And I will go now that I've just rewatched 28 Days Later and eventually watch that, maybe in the next couple of weeks.
It is. I loved it, and I was not expecting to, for all the same reasons you just mentioned. It's like, you know, when they announced that it was coming out, I'm like, you know, Alex Garland isn't writing it. Danny Boyle isn't directing. Kind of, you know, what's the point? You know, but I worked at a movie theater at the time, and I previewed the film when it came out, and, you know, just to give it a shot. And it wound up being one of my favorite movies that year. It's a very different film than the first, but it's so beautifully made, and it's so, like, the performances in it are great, and it's unrelentingly intense, even more so than the first one. I think the first one is probably still the best movie, but the sequel is surprisingly strong, and it really puts you through the ringer throughout the course of its runtime. It's unbearably intense at times.
Oh, wow, I have to watch that. Because, I mean, one could argue that with 28 Days Later, you know, when I was watching it's tense, but it's, you know, I mean, there's probably like, I don't know, 20 infected that you see the whole time. I mean, it's surprisingly, I guess that's one of the advantages of fast zombies. You don't need to have 200, you know, or 800 extras. But, you know, it's not always really tense. I mean, it's not like, you know, watch some films and you think your heart's going to explode for 2 hours. But I mean, having said that, I still love it. I mean, I think it's amazing that it's done so well, and it's such an incredibly popular film and such a great film, and yet it's not ratcheted up fully all the time. But I would love to see those infected or zombies on a really intense film. So I'll definitely go watch 28 Weeks Later.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is, you know, like, it is a bigger movie, but, you know, it's not a movie that forgets the, you know, the sort of heart or, you know, the connection to the characters that the first film had. So, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out.
I'm going to download that on my next flight. So there you go.
It's so good. And plus it's a great kind of sequel in that it sort of serves to explore that world without really dealing with any of the characters from the previous movie. So it doesn't really trample on the story of, you know, Jim or Selena or Hannah, you know, and I really appreciate that in a way, because by the time you get to the end of the original movie, it has a rare happy ending for a zombie movie, you know, and it feels very earned. Like those characters deserve their happy ending by the final moments, I think.
Yeah. You know, interesting. I was, they had, speaking of the ending, I think from what either Killian told me or I read or something, but I think the original idea for the ending was not so happy. I think actually there was an ending, and I believe they may have even shown this ending once or twice, but the ending was Jim dying in the hospital.
Yes.
And the two women walking off. So, and I think that ultimately people thought that was just a little too depressing, because there's not much chance that anyone's going to survive at all. And they came with a happy ending. I watched the ending because I like that it has a happy ending. I'm glad it does. But a bit of me also kind of, maybe I'm just more familiar with zombie movies than not having happy endings. But that, you know, whether it would have been just as good if, yeah, Jim had died in the hospital at the end. I don't know. And I think that was the choice of Danny Boyle and Alex Garland. That was what they kind of wanted to be the ending, but they went with the other one. It would never have done as well in America if they'd kept that ending, that's for sure.
Oh, totally.
I mean, it was incredible. I became good friends with Killian right before this was released, and it did pretty well in England. It got good reviews, and it did well, but, you know, then it wasn't released in America until June or July of 2003, so it was about 7 or 8, you know, 6 or 7 months later, and I was hanging out with Killian Lowe's, we'd go on, you know, movies or whatever, theater and stuff, and he was just a regular guy, and then I remember we went to see a play in, like, July or June of 2003, and he said to me, dude, you won't imagine, you know, you won't believe what just happened. Like, it's all kicked off for me, because I guess 28 Days Later, for some reason, became this massive summer hit of 2003 and made like $45 million on a budget of whatever it is, $3 million or a couple million or whatever. And, overnight he was suddenly flying off to do Batman auditions and all these things that, you know, were definitely not in sight prior to that, but the movie just became this summer sleeper hit of that year. No one expected it at all, you know, to happen, but it definitely hit some kind of nerve or did something that summer where people in the States just loved it. It was, I think, more popular in America than it was really in Britain. at that point.
You know, it is crazy too that it was that, you know, Fox even released it in the summer. You know, I remember when I heard that it was finally coming to the U.S., I was so excited. I was like, great, you know, I'll be able to see it on the big screen rather than going straight to DVD or something like that, which, you know, some amazing, you know, foreign films do from time to time. And the fact that it was going into theaters was great, but I'm like, why are they releasing this in the summer? Why not closer to Halloween? And I remember a group of my friends and I, we went to, it didn't come to my theater, unfortunately, so we went to a neighboring town to catch it. And I remember thinking, wow, we're going to be the only three people in that auditorium, right? It was sold out. It was it was packed to the gills, you know, and it was incredible watching a movie like that, you know, shot on video, zombie movie, which hadn't been popular in a while, you know, not a whole lot of marketing behind it. And yet the theater was completely sold out with people who loved watching the film.
Yeah. It was weird. It just really struck a nerve that summer. It's quite extraordinary because it's not, I can't think of a lot of, I'm sure there's plenty of them, but they don't pop in my mind of films that really unexpectedly released, like you said, at a really odd time to release a film in amongst all the summer blockbusters, that low budget, shot on video, you know, totally unexpected to, you know, gross that much money and become that popular, and really just become a big, huge hit. It's really unusual. And as I said, it completely transformed, literally overnight, Cillian Murphy's life. I mean, overnight. And I've not seen that before, too. I obviously have been an actor for almost 25, 30 years now. And you know, it's rare I've seen somebody just have something literally overnight turn them into a movie star. But that happened to him.
That's amazing.
Summer of 2003.
Why is it, do you think, you know, if we look at 28 Days Later and then certainly with the massive success with The Walking Dead on television, what is it, do you think, what is it about zombies that captures the attention of massive audiences, do you think? What is it about them that sort of resonates with people?
You know, I mean, I thought, because, yeah, I thought about this when I did, because I did Game of Thrones for a while and was doing this guy, the King of the White Walkers, and one of their things is they can raise people from the dead, right? And so there's this sort of army of dead people in that. And I think that I thought about this with that, and I think it's true, is that I think for one of our deepest fears, like very deep fears, and why that TV show really connects with people throughout the world, and is it really touches on a lot of our deepest stuff. And one of our deepest fears, I think, is that once we die, it's not all over for us. I think that there's a certain level of, like, that we have in us that, well, at least when we're dead, it all is over. You know, whether we believe we go to heaven or whatever, but we're not still wandering around in the earth in this way. And I think it really is a deep fear that we'll die and then be not even in control at all of ourselves. We'll just be this kind of, you know, walking dead thing. I think that's a sort of a deep fear in people. I think it touches on that. That's one of the reasons. And I also think that, again, it's about like fear of lack of control, that these things coming after us are completely out of control, whether they be slow moving or there's just tons of them, or whether they're these fast infected that are in 28 Days Later. Is that they have no remorse, nothing. They're completely out of control. And that terrifies us, things out of control coming at us. I think that's a big part of 28 Days Later, is that, you know, because it's called rage, right? The thing that's infected in these people. And I think that they really tapped into this fear we have of our own rage, of rage just kind of overwhelming us, whether it's, you know, just the rage, basically rage of being alive in the 21st century. And I think that's another reason that we're frightened of these creatures, these undead or whatever they are.
I agree. And I can't think of any better way to end than on that note. Sir, I think we've just about reached our time. I don't want to keep you too long. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And thanks for choosing 28 Days Later. I think, you know, it's a modern classic, I think, yet it's one that's not talked about as often as it should be, I don't think. So I was happy to chat about it at length with you.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad to get to revisit it. So thank you.
Can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can they keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Let's see. Online, they can. I've got Twitter and Instagram and all that. Keep an eye on that because it'll tell you what I'm up to. I just finished shooting a film, again, a small British independent horror film / psychological thriller called Perfect Skin, which I just completed about a couple of weeks ago, which will be hopefully out sometime next year. And that's kind of terrifying. You'll like that. It's very scary. And I'm about to embark on another film, another horror film shooting in Bulgaria, which starts up later this next month. So doing that. And then lots of bits and pieces. I tend to show up, cause some mayhem, get killed. So keep an eye out.
Very cool. Well, thank you again, sir.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
All right. And thanks to all you listeners out there. Please be sure to like, subscribe, share, and maybe write us in the comments section below or leave us an iTunes review. Check out our YouTube show. If we get enough views, we'll possibly make some more someday. Be sure to purchase 28 Days Later and Mr. Briggs Films using the Amazon links below. And remember, any purchase you make through our Amazon links will keep this podcast going. So thanks for that. Also, find that Audible deal on our site. If you sign up for a free 30-day trial, you'll get 2 free books. Until next time, gang, thanks so much and have a great weekend.
That was longer than a heartbeat.